as downstairs the coffee was making itself. Outside, he could see the towers of the Roosevelt Island tramway. Their bedroom, his and Maggie's, faced the East River. Glass, as thick as an unabridged copy of War and Peace, blocked the endless roar of the FDR Drive. It was bulletproof, along with all the other windows in the townhouse. The billionaire had paid for the installation after 9/11.
"Can't afford to lose you to some jihadi cab driver with a shoulder rocket," he told David.
Today was Friday, August 24th. Maggie and the kids were out at the vineyard, had been all month, leaving David to pad the marble bathroom floors alone. Downstairs, he could hear the housekeeper making breakfast. After a shower, he stopped at the kids' rooms, as he did every morning, and stared at their perfectly made beds. The decor in Rachel's room combined scientific gadgetry and horse worship. JJ's was all about cars. Like all children, they tended toward chaos, a juvenile disorder the house staff erased systematically, often in real time. Now, staring at the sterile, vacuumed order, David found himself wanting to mess things up, to make his son's room look more like a kid's and less like a museum of childhood. So he went over to a toy bin and kicked it over with his foot.
"There," he thought. "That's better."
He would leave a note for the maid. When the children left town, she was to leave their rooms as she found them. He would tape them off like a crime scene if he had to, anything to make the house feel more alive. He called Maggie from the kitchen. The clock on the stove read 6:14 a.m.
"We've been up for an hour," she said. "Rachel's reading. JJ is seeing what happens when you pour dish soap in the toilet."
Her voice was muffled as she covered the mouthpiece.
"Sweetie," she yelled, "that is not what we call a good choice."
In New York, David mimed drinking, and the housekeeper brought him more coffee. His wife came back on the line. David could hear the frazzled energy she got in her voice when she spent too long parenting by herself. Every year he tried to get her to bring Maria, the au pair, with them to the island, but his wife always refused. Summer vacation was for them, she said. Family time. Otherwise, Rachel and JJ would grow up calling the nanny Mommy, like all the other kids in their neighborhood.
"It's super foggy out," his wife said.
"Did you get the thing I sent?" he asked.
"Yes," she said, sounding pleased. "Where did you find them?"
"The Kiplings. They know a guy who travels the world collecting old world clippings. Apples from the 1800s. Peach trees no one's seen since McKinley was president. We had that fruit salad at their place last summer."
"Right," she said. "That was yummy. Were they... is it silly to ask? Were they expensive? This seems like something that you'd hear on the news as the price of a new car."
"A Vespa, maybe," he said.
It was just like her to ask price, as if part of her still couldn't fathom their net worth, its implications.
"I didn't even know there was such a thing as a Danish plum," she said.
"Me either. Who knew the world of fruit could be so exotic?"
She laughed. When things were good between them, there was an easiness, a rhythm of give and take that came from living in the moment, from burying old grudges. Some mornings when he called, David could tell that she had dreamed about him in the night. It was something she did from time to time. Often she told him afterward, biting off her words, unable to look him in the eye. In the dream, he was always a monster who scorned and abandoned her. The conversations that followed were chilly and brief.
"Well, we're going to plant the trees this morning," Maggie told him. "It'll give us a project for the day."
They made small talk for another 10 minutes, what his day looked like, what time he thought he'd be out tonight. All the while his phone chimed, breaking news, schedule changes, crises to be managed. The sound of other people's panic reduced to a steady electronic hum. Meanwhile, the kids buzzed in and out of Maggie's end of the line like yellow jackets scouting a picnic. He liked hearing them in the background, the melee of them. It was what set his generation apart from his father's. David wanted his children to have a childhood, a real childhood. He worked hard so that they could play. For David's father, childhood had been a luxury his son could not afford. Play was considered a gateway drug to idleness and poverty. Life, Dad said, was a Hail Mary. You only got one shot at it, and if you didn't train every day with wind sprints and grass drills, you would blow it. As a result, David had been burdened with chores at an early age. At 5, he was cleaning the trash cans. By 7, he was doing all their laundry. The rule in their house was that homework was done and chores were completed before a single ball was thrown, before a bike was ridden, or army men were dumped from the Folgers can. "You don't become a man by accident," his father told him. It was a belief that David shared, though his was a milder version. In David's mind, the training for adulthood began in the double digits. At 10, he reasoned, it was time to start thinking about growing up, to take the soft-serve lessons about discipline and responsibility that had been fed to you in your youth and cement them into rules for a healthy and productive life. Until then, you were a child, so act accordingly.
"Daddy," said Rachel, "will you bring my red sneakers? They're in my closet."
He walked into her room and got them while they were talking so he wouldn't forget. "I'm putting them in my bag," he told her.
"It's me again," said Maggie. "Next year I think you should come out here with us for the whole month."
"Me too," he said immediately. Every year they had the same conversation. Every year he said the same thing. "I will." And then he didn't.
"It's just the fucking news," she said. "There'll be more tomorrow. Besides, haven't you trained them all by now?"
"I promise," he said. "Next year I'll be there more."
Because it was easier to say yes than to dicker through the real-world probabilities, lay out all the mitigating factors, and try to manage her expectations. "Never fight tomorrow's fight today," was his motto.
"Liar," she said, but with a smile in her voice.
"I love you," he told her. "I'll see you tonight."
The town car was downstairs waiting for him. Two security contractors from the agency rode up in the elevator to get him. They slept in shifts in one of the first-floor guest rooms.
"Morning, boys," said David, shrugging on his jacket.
They took him out together. Two big men with Sig Sauers under their coats, eyes scanning the street for signs of threat. Every day David got hate mail. Apoplectic letters about God knows what, sometimes even care packages of human shit. It was the price he paid for choosing a side, he reasoned, for having an opinion about politics and war. "Fuck you and your God," they said. They threatened his life. His family. Threats he had learned to take seriously. In the town car, he thought about Rachel. The 3 days she was missing. Ransom calls. The living room filled with FBI agents and private security. Maggie crying in the back bedroom. It was a miracle they got her back. A miracle that he knew would never happen twice. So they lived with the constant surveillance. The advance team. Safety first, he told his children, then fun, then learning. It was a joke between them. He was driven cross town through the stop and go. Every 2 seconds his phone blorped. North Korea was test firing missiles into the Sea of Japan again. A Tallahassee policeman was in a coma after a car stop shooting. Nude cell phone photos of a Hollywood starlet sent to an NFL running back had just dropped. If you weren't careful, it could feel like a tidal wave bearing down, all this eventfulness. But David saw it for what it was, and understood his own role. He was a sorting machine, boxing the news by category and priority, forwarding tips to various departments. He wrote one-word replies and hit send. Bullshit, or weak, or more. He had answered 33 emails and returned 16 phone calls by the time the car pulled up in front of the ALC building on 6th Avenue, and that was light for a Friday. A security man opened the back door for him. David stepped out into the bustle. Outside, the air was the temperature and consistency of a patty melt. He was wearing a steel-gray suit with a white shirt and a red tie. Sometimes in the mornings, he liked to veer away from the front door at the last second and wander off to find a second breakfast. It kept the security guys on their toes. But today he had things to do if he was going to make it to the airport by 3. David's office was on the 58th floor. He came off the elevator at a fast clip, eyes focused on his office door. People got out of the way when he walked. They ducked into cubicles. They turned and fled. It wasn't the man so much as the office. Or maybe it was the suit. The faces around him seemed to get younger every day, David thought. Segment producers and executive administrators. Online nerds with soul patches and artisanal coffee, smug with the knowledge that they were the future. Everyone in this business was building a legacy. Some were ideologues, others were opportunists, but they were all there because ALC was the number one cable news network in the country, and David Bateman was the reason. Lydia Cox, his secretary, was already at her desk. She had been with David since 1995, a 59-year-old woman who had never married, but had never owned a cat. Lydia was thin. Her hair was short, and she carried a certain old-school Brooklyn chutzpah that, like a once-thriving Indian tribe, had long since been driven from the borough by hostile gentrifiers from across the sea. "You've got the Sellers call in 10 minutes," she reminded him first thing. David didn't slow. He went into his desk, took off his jacket, and hung it on the back of his chair. Lydia had put his schedule on the seat. He picked it up, frowned. Starting the day with Sellers, the increasingly unpopular L.A. bureau chief, was like starting the day with a colonoscopy. "Hasn't somebody stabbed this guy yet?" he said. "No," said Lydia, following him in. "But last year you did buy a burial plot in his name and send him a picture of it for Christmas." David smiled. As far as he was concerned, there weren't enough moments like that in life.
"Push it to Monday," he told her.
"He's called twice already. Don't you dare let him blow this off," was the gist.
"Too late."
There was a hot cup of coffee on David's desk. He pointed to it.
"For me?"
"No," she said, shaking her head. "It's the Pope's."
Bill Cunningham appeared in the doorway behind her. He was in jeans, a T-shirt, and his trademark red suspenders.
"Hey," he said. "Got a sec?"
Lydia turned to go. As Bill stepped aside to let her pass, David noticed Krista Brewer hovering behind him. She looked worried.
"Sure," said David. "What's up?"
They came in. Bill closed the door behind them, which wasn't something he normally did. Cunningham was a performance artist. His whole shtick was built on a rant against secret backroom meetings. In other words, nothing he did was ever private. Instead, he preferred to go into David's office twice a week and yell his head off. About what didn't matter. It was a show of force, like a military exercise. So the closed door was a concern.
"Bill," said David, "did you just close the door?"
He looked at Krista, Bill's executive producer. She seemed a little green. Bill dropped onto the sofa. He had the wingspan of a pterodactyl. He sat, as he always did, with his knees spread wide so you could see how big his balls were.
"First of all," he said, "it's not as bad as you think."
"No," said Krista, "it's worse."
"2 days of bullshit," said Bill. "Maybe the lawyers get involved. Maybe."
David got up and looked out the window.
He found the best thing you could do with a showman like Bill was not look at him. "Whose lawyers?" he asked. "Yours or mine?"
"God damn it, Bill," said Krista, turning on the anchor. "This isn't a rule you broke. Don't spit in church. It's a law. Several laws, probably."
David watched the traffic go by on Fifth Avenue. "I'm going to the airport at 3, he said. "Do you think we'll have reached the point by then, or are we going to have to finish this by phone?"
He turned and looked at them. Krista's arms were crossed defiantly.
"Bill's gotta say it," was her body language.
Messengers get killed for delivering bad news, and Krista wasn't going to lose her job for another one of Cunningham's dumb mistakes. Bill, meanwhile, had an angry smile on his face, like a cop after a shooting he'll swear on the stand was justified.
"Krista," said David.
"He tapped people's phones," she said.
The words hung there, a crisis point, but not yet a full-blown crisis. "People," David echoed cautiously, the word bitter on his tongue.
Krista looked at Bill.
"Bill has this guy," she said.
"Namor," said Bill. "You remember Namor, former Navy SEAL, former Pentagon intel."
David shook his head. In the last few years, Bill had taken to surrounding himself with a bunch of Gordon Liddy kooks.
"Sure you do," Bill said. "Well, we're drinking one night, this is maybe a year ago, and we're talking about Moskowitz. You remember the congressman who liked smelling black girls' feet? Well, Namor is laughing, and he says, wouldn't it be great if we had those phone calls on tape? Broadcast gold, right? A Jewish congressman telling some black chick how he wants to smell her feet. And so I say, yes, that would be good. And whatever, we order a couple more 7-7s, and Namor says, you know..."
Bill paused for dramatic effect. He couldn't help it. It was in his nature to perform.
"You know, it's not hard. This is Namor. In fact, he says, it's a fucking cinch, because everything goes through a server. Everyone has email, cell phones, they've got voicemail passwords and text messaging usernames, and that shit is all accessible. It's crackable. Hell, if you know somebody's phone number, you can just clone their phone. So every time they get a call..."
"No," said David, feeling a hot flush climb up his spine from his asshole.
"Whatever," said Bill. "It's two guys in a bar at 1 in the morning. It's just bullshit cocksmanship." But then he said, "Pick a name. Somebody whose phone calls you want to hear. So I say, Obama. And he says that's the White House, not possible. Pick somebody else, lower down. So I say, Kellerman. You know, that piece of shit liberal reactionary on CNN. And he says, done."
David found himself in his chair, though he couldn't remember sitting. And Krista was looking at him like, "It gets worse."
"Bill," said David, shaking his head, his hands up. "Stop. I can't hear this. You should be talking to a lawyer."
"That's what I told him," said Krista.
Cunningham waved them off like they were a couple of Pakistani orphans at an Islamabad bazaar.
"I didn't do anything," he said. "Picked a name. And who cares anyway? We're two drunks at a bar. So I go home, forget about the whole thing. A week later, Namor comes to the office. He wants to show me something. So we go into my office and he takes out a zip drive, puts it in my computer. It's got all these audio files on it. Fucking Kellerman, right? Talking to his mother, his dry cleaner, but also to his producer about cutting some bits from a story to make it skew a different way."
David felt a moment of vertigo.
"Is that how you..." he said. "Shit, yes. We found the original footage and ran the piece. You loved that story."
David was standing again, fists clenched.
"When I thought it was journalism," he said, "not..."
Bill laughed, shaking his head with wonder at his own inventiveness.
"I gotta play these tapes for you. It's classic."
David came around the desk, Stop talking.
Where are you going?
Bill asked. Don't say another fucking word to anyone, David told him. Either of you. And walked out of his office.
Lydia was at her desk. I've got Sellers on line two, she said.
David didn't stop. Didn't turn. He walked through rows of cubicles, sweat dripping down his sides. This could be the end of them. He knew it in his bones. Didn't even have to hear the rest of the story.
Move!
He yelled at a group of crew cuts in short-sleeved shirts. They scattered like rabbits. Mind racing, David reached the elevator bank, pushed the button, then, without waiting, kicked open the door to the stairs, went down a floor. He stalked the halls like a spree killer with an assault rifle, found Liebling in the conference room, sitting with 16 other lawyers.
Out, said David. Everybody!
They scrambled, these nameless suits with their law degrees, the door hitting the last one on the heels. Sitting there, Don Liebling had a bemused look on his face. He was their in-house counsel, mid-50s and Pilates fit.
Jesus, Bateman, he said.
David paced.
Cunningham, was all he could say for a moment. Shit, said Liebling. What did that wet dick do now? I only heard some of it, David said. I cut him off before I could become an accessory after the fact.
Liebling frowned.
Tell me there isn't a dead hooker in a hotel room somewhere.
I wish, David said. A dead hooker would be easy compared to this.
Looking up, he saw an airplane high above the Empire State Building. For a moment, his need to be on it, going somewhere, anywhere, was overwhelming. He dropped into a leather chair, ran his hand through his hair.
The fucktard tapped Kellerman's phone. Probably others. I got the feeling he was going to start listing victims like a serial killer, so I left.
Liebling smoothed his tie.
When you say tapped his phone, he has a guy, some intel consultant, who said he could get Bill access to anybody's email or phone.
Jesus.
David leaned back in the chair and looked up at the ceiling.
You have to talk to him.
Liebling nodded.
He needs his own lawyer, he said. I think he uses Franken. I'll call.
David tapped his fingers on the tabletop. He felt old.
I mean, what if it was congressmen or senators, he asked. My God! It's bad enough he's spying on the competition!
Liebling thought about that. David closed his eyes and pictured Rachel and JJ digging holes in the backyard, planting old-world apple trees. He should have taken the month off. Should be there with them right now, flip-flops on, a Bloody Mary in hand, laughing every time his son said,
"What's up, chicken butt?"
"Could this sink us?" he asked, eyes still shut. Liebling equivocated with his head.
"It sinks him, that's for sure. But it hurts us."
"Without a doubt," said Liebling. "A thing like this, there could be congressional hearings. At the very least, you've got the FBI up your ass for 2 years. They'll talk about pulling our broadcast license."
David thought about this.
"Do I resign?"
"Why? You didn't know anything. Did you?"
"It doesn't matter. A thing like this. If I didn't know, I should have."
He shook his head.
Fucking Bill.
But it wasn't Bill's fault, thought David. It was his. Cunningham was David's gift to the world. The angry white man people invited into their living rooms to call bullshit at the world, to rail against a system that robbed us of everything we felt we deserved. The third world countries that were taking our jobs, the politicians who were raising our taxes. Bill Cunningham, Mr. Straight Talk, Mr. Divine Righteousness, who sat in our living rooms and shared our pain, who told us what we wanted to hear, which was that the reason we were losing out in life was not that we were losers,
but that someone was reaching into our pockets, our companies, our country, and taking what was rightfully ours. Bill Cunningham was the voice of ALC News, and he had gone insane. He was Kurtz in the jungle. And David should have realized, should have pulled him back. But the ratings were too good, and the shots Bill was taking at the enemy were direct hits. They were the number one network, and that meant everything. Was Bill a diva? Absolutely. But divas can be handled. Lunatics, on the other hand...
I've got to call Roger, he said, meaning the billionaire, meaning his boss.
The boss.
And say what? Said Liebling. That this thing is coming. That it's out there, and he should get ready. You need to find Bill and pull him into a room and beat him with a sock full of oranges. Get Frank in here. Get the truth, and then protect us from it.
Does he go on tonight? David thought about this.
No. He's sick. He has the flu.
He won't like that.
Tell him the alternative is he goes to jail or we break his kneecaps. Call Hancock. We put it out there this morning that Bill's sick. On Monday we run a best of week. I don't want this guy on my air again.
He won't go quietly.
No, said David. He won't.
Injuries. At night, when Scott dreams, he dreams of the shark, sleek-muscled and greedy. He wakes thirsty. The hospital is an ecosystem of beeps and hums. Outside, the sun is just coming up. He looks over at the boy, still asleep. The television is on at low volume, white noise haunting their sleep. The screen is split into fifths, a news crawl snaking across the floor. On screen, the search for survivors continues. It appears the Navy has brought in divers and deep-sea submersibles to try to find the underwater wreckage, to recover the bodies of the dead. Scott watches as men in black wetsuits step from the deck of a Coast Guard cutter and vanish into the sea.
They're calling it an accident, Bill Cunningham is saying from the screen's largest box, a tall man with dramatic hair thumbing his suspenders. But you and I know there are no accidents. Planes don't just fall out of the sky, the same way that our president didn't just forget that Congress was on vacation when he made that hack Rodriguez a judge.
Cunningham is smoky-eyed, his tie askew. He has been on the air for 9 hours now, delivering a marathon eulogy for his dead leader.
The David Bateman I knew, he says, my boss, my friend, couldn't be killed by mechanical failure or pilot error. He was an avenging angel, an American hero. And this reporter believes that what we're talking about here is nothing less than an act of terrorism, if not by foreign nationals, then by certain elements of the liberal media. Planes don't just crash, people. This was sabotage. This was a shoulder-fired rocket from a speedboat. This was a jihadi in a suicide vest on board the aircraft, possibly one of the crew. Murder, my friends, by the enemies of freedom. 9 dead, including a 9-year-old girl. 9! A girl who had already suffered tragedy in her life. A girl I held in my arms at birth, whose diaper I changed. We should be fueling up the fighter jets. SEAL teams should be jumping from high-altitude planes and sharking up from submarines. A great patriot is dead. The godfather of freedom in the West. And we will get to the bottom of things.
Scott turns down the volume. The boy stirs but does not wake. In sleep, he is not yet an orphan. In sleep, his parents are still alive. His sister. They kiss him on the cheeks and tickle his ribs. In sleep, it is last week, and he is running through the sand, holding a squirmy green crab by the claw. He is drinking orange soda through a straw and eating curly fries, his brown hair bleached by the sun, freckles splashed across his face. And when he wakes up, there will be that moment when all the dreams are real.
when the love he carries up with him is enough to keep the truth at bay. But then the moment will end. The boy will see Scott's face, or a nurse will come in, and just like that he will be an orphan again, this time forever. Scott turns and looks out the window. They are meant to be discharged today, Scott and the boy, expelled from the looped loudspeaker of hospital life, BP checked every half hour, temperature taken, meals delivered. The boy's aunt and uncle arrived last night, red-eyed and somber. The aunt is Maggie's younger sister, Eleanor. She sleeps now in a hard-backed chair beside the boy's bed. Eleanor is in her early 30s and pretty, a massage therapist from Croton-on-Hudson, upstate. Her husband, the boy's uncle, is a writer, squirrely about eye contact, the kind of knucklehead who grows a beard in summer. Scott doesn't have a good feeling about him. It has been 32 hours since the crash, a heartbeat and a lifetime. Scott has yet to bathe, his skin still salty from the sea. His left arm is in a sling. He has no ID, no pants. And yet despite this, his idea is still to head into the city later as planned. There are meetings on the books, career connections to be made. Scott's friend Magnus has offered to drive out to Montauk and get him. Lying there, Scott thinks it will be good to see him, a friendly face. They are not close, really, he and Magnus, nothing like brothers, more like drinking buddies. But Magnus is both unflappable and relentlessly positive, which is why Scott thought to call him last night. It was essential that he avoid talking to anyone who might cry. Keep things casual. That was his goal. In fact, after he'd finished telling Magnus, who didn't own a TV, what had happened, Magnus said, "Weird," and then suggested they should grab a beer. Looking over, Scott sees that the boy is awake now, staring at him unblinking. "Hey, buddy," says Scott quietly, so as not to wake the aunt. "You sleep okay?" The boy nods. "Want me to put on some cartoons?" Another nod. Scott finds the remote, turns channels until he finds something animated. "SpongeBob?" Scott asks. The boy nods again. He hasn't spoken a word since yesterday afternoon. In the first few hours after they reached shore, it was possible to get a few words out of him, how he was feeling, if he needed anything. But then, like a wound swelling shut, he stopped speaking, and now he is mute. Scott spies a box of powdery rubber exam gloves on the table. As the boy watches, he pulls one out. "Uh-oh," he says, then quietly fakes the big build-up to a sneeze. With the achoo, he hangs the glove from his left nostril. The boy smiles. The aunt wakes, stretches. She is a beautiful woman with a blunt bang haircut, like a person who makes up for driving an expensive car by never washing it. Scott watches her face as she regains full consciousness, as she realizes where she is and what has happened. For a moment he sees her threaten to collapse under the weight of it, but then she sees the boy and forces a smile. "Hey," she says, smoothing the hair back from his face. She looks up at the TV and then at Scott. "Morning," he says. She brushes her own hair off her face, checks to make sure her clothes are on properly. "Sorry," she says. "I guess I fell asleep." It doesn't feel like a comment that deserves a response, so Scott just nods. Eleanor looks around. "Have you seen Doug, my husband?"
"I think he went to get some coffee," Scott tells her.
"Good," she says, looking relieved.
"That's good."
"You two been married a long time?" Scott asks her.
"No, just, 71 days.
"But who's counting?" says Scott.
Eleanor flushes.
"He's a sweet guy," she says. "I think he's just a little overwhelmed right now."
Scott glances at the boy, who has stopped watching the TV and is studying Scott and his aunt. The idea that Doug is overwhelmed, given what they've been through, is mystifying.
"Did the boy's father have any family?" Scott asks. "Your brother-in-law?"
"David?"
she says.
"No. I mean, His parents are dead, and he's... I mean, I guess he was an only child.
What about your parents?
My, mom is still around. She lives in Portland. I think she's flying in today.
Scott nods. And you guys live in Woodstock?
Croton, she says. It's about 40 minutes outside the city.
Scott thinks about this. A small house in a wooded glen, easy chairs on a porch. It could be good for the boy. Then again, it could be disastrous, the isolation of the woods, the glowering, drunken rider like Jack Nicholson in the Winter Mountains. Has he ever been there? Scott asks, nodding toward the boy. She purses her lips.
I'm sorry, she says, but why are you asking me all these questions?
Well, says Scott, I guess I'm just curious as to what's going to happen to him now. I'm invested, you could say.
Eleanor nods. She looks scared, not of Scott, but of life, what her life is about to become. We'll be fine, she says, rubbing the boy's head. Right?
He doesn't answer, his eyes focused on Scott. There is a challenge in them, a plea. Scott blinks first, then turns and looks out the window. Doug comes in. He's holding a cup of coffee and wearing a misbuttoned cardigan over a checked lumberjack shirt. Seeing him, Eleanor looks relieved.
Is that for me?
She asks, pointing. For a moment, Doug looks confused. Then he realizes she means the coffee.
Sure,
he says, and hands it to her. Scott can tell from the way she holds it that the cup is almost empty. He sees her face get sad. Doug comes around the boy's bed and stands near his wife. Scott can smell alcohol on his clothes.
How's the patient? Doug asks.
He's good, says Eleanor. Got some sleep.
Studying Doug's back, Scott wonders how much money the boy stands to inherit from his parents. 5 million? 50? His father ran a TV empire and flew in private planes. There will be riches. Real estate. Sniffling, Doug hikes up his pants with both hands. He pulls a small toy car from his pocket. It still has the price tag on it.
Here you go, slugger, he says. Got this for you.
There are a lot of sharks in the sea, thinks Scott, watching the boy take the car. Dr. Gladman enters, eyeglasses perched on top of his head. He has a bright yellow banana sticking out of his lab coat pocket. Ready to go home? He asks. They get dressed. The hospital gives Scott a pair of blue surgical scrubs to wear. He puts them on one-handed, wincing as the nurse maneuvers his fragile left arm into the sleeve. When he comes out of the bathroom, the boy is already dressed and sitting in a wheelchair. I'm giving you the name of a child psychiatrist, the doctor tells Eleanor out of earshot of the boy. He specializes in post-traumatic cases.
We actually don't live in the city, says Doug.
Eleanor shushes him with a look.
Of course, she says, taking the business card from the doctor. I'll call this afternoon.
Scott crosses to the boy, kneels on the floor in front of him.
You be good, he says.
The boy shakes his head, tears in his eyes.
I'll see you, Scott tells him. I'm giving your aunt my phone number, so you can call, okay?
The boy won't look at him. Scott touches his tiny arm for a moment, unsure what to do next. He has never had a child, never been an uncle or a godfather. He's not even sure they speak the same language. After a moment, Scott straightens and hands Eleanor a piece of paper with his phone number. Obviously, call any time, he says. Not that I know what I can do to help, but if he wants to talk, or you. Doug takes the number from his wife. He folds it up and jams it in his back pocket.
Sounds good, man, he says.
Scott stands for a minute, looking at Eleanor, then at the boy, and finally at Doug. It feels like an important moment, like one of those critical junctures in life when you're supposed to say something or do something, but you don't know what. Only later does it hit you. Later, the thing you should have said will be as clear as day, but right now it's just a nagging feeling, a clenched jaw and low nausea.
Okay, he says finally and walks to the door, thinking he will just go. That's the best thing. To let the boy be with his family. But then as he steps into the hall, he feels two small arms grab his leg, and he turns to see the boy holding on to him. The hall is full of people, patients and visitors, doctors and nurses. Scott puts a hand on the boy's head, then bends and picks him up. The boy's arms encircle his neck, and he hugs hard enough to cut off Scott's air. Scott blinks away tears. "Don't forget," he tells the boy. "You're my hero." He lets the boy hug himself out, then carries him back to the wheelchair. Scott can feel Eleanor and Doug watching him, but he keeps his eyes on the boy. "Never give up," he tells him. Then Scott turns and walks off down the hall. In the early years, when he was deep in a painting, Scott felt like he was underwater. There was that same pressure between the ears, the same muted silence. Colors were sharper. Light rippled and bent. He had his first group show at 26, his first solo show at 30. Every dime he could scrabble together was spent on canvas and paint. Somewhere along the way, he stopped swimming. There were galleries to commandeer and women to fuck, and he was a tall, green-eyed flirt with a contagious smile, which meant there was always a girl to buy him breakfast or put a roof over his head, at least for a few nights. At the time, this almost made up for the fact that his work was good, not great. Looking at it, you could see he had potential, a unique voice, but something was missing. Years passed. The big solo shows and high-profile museum acquisitions never happened. The German biennials and genius grants, the invitations to paint and teach abroad. He turned 30. 35. One night, after several cocktails at his third gallery opening of the week to celebrate an artist 5 years younger than himself, it occurred to Scott that he would never become the overnight success he thought he'd be, the enfant terrible, the downtown superstar. The heady exhilaration of artistic possibility had become elusive and frightening. He was a minor artist. That's all he'd ever be. The parties were still good. The women were still beautiful, but Scott felt uglier. As the rootlessness of youth was replaced by middle-aged self-involvement, his affairs turned quick and dirty. He drank to forget. Alone in his studio, Scott took to staring at the canvas for hours, waiting for images to appear. Nothing ever came. He woke up one day and found he was a 40-year-old man with 20 years of booze and debauchery ballooning his middle and weathering his face. He had been engaged once, and then not, had sobered and fallen from the wagon. He had been young once, and limitless, and then somehow his life became a foregone conclusion. An almost was, not even a has-been. Scott could see the obituary. Scott Burrows, a talented, rakish charmer who had never lived up to his promise, who had long since crossed the line from fun-loving and mysterious to boorish and sad. But who was he kidding? Even the obituary was a fantasy. He was a nobody. His death would warrant nothing. Then, after a week-long party at the Hamptons' house of a much more successful painter, Scott found himself lying face down on the living room floor. He was 46 years old. It was barely dawn. He staggered to his feet and out onto the patio. His head was pounding and his mouth tasted like a radial tire. He squinted in the glare of sudden sunlight, his hand rising to shield his face. The truth about him, his failure, came back as a throbbing head pain. And then, as his eyes adjusted, he lowered his hand and found himself staring into the famous artist's swimming pool. It was there that the artist and his girlfriend found Scott an hour later, naked and swimming laps, his chest on fire, his muscles aching. They yelled at him to come for a drink with them, but Scott waved them off. He felt alive again. The moment he entered the water, it was like he was 18 again and winning a gold medal at the national championship. He was 16, executing a perfect underwater pivot,
He was 12, and getting up before dawn to slice the blue. He swam backward through time, lap after lap, until he was 6 years old and watching Jack LaLanne tow a 1,000-pound boat through San Francisco Bay, until that feeling returned, that deep boy certainty. Anything is possible. Everything is gettable. You just have to want it badly enough. Scott wasn't old, it turned out. He wasn't finished. He had just given up. 30 minutes later, he climbed out of the pool and, without drying off, put on his clothes and went back to the city. For the next 6 months, he swam 3 miles a day. He threw away the booze and the cigarettes. He cut out red meat and dessert. He bought canvas after canvas, covering every available surface with an expectant white primer. He was a boxer training for a fight, a cellist practicing for a concert. His body was his instrument, battered like Johnny Cash's guitar, splintered and raw, but he was going to turn it into a Stradivarius. He was a disaster survivor in that he had survived the disaster that was his life. And so that's what he painted. That summer he rented a small house on Martha's Vineyard and holed up. Once again, the only thing that mattered was the work, except now he realized that the work was him. There is no separating yourself from the things you make, he thought. If you are a cesspool, what else can your work be except shit? He got a 3-legged dog and cooked her spaghetti and meatballs. Every day was the same. An ocean swim, coffee and a pastry at the farmer's market, then hours of open time in his studio, brushstrokes and paint, lines and color. What he saw when he finished was too exciting to say out loud. He had made the great leap forward, and knowing this, he became strangely terrified. The work became his secret, a treasure chest hidden in the rocky ground. Only recently had he come out of hiding, first by attending a few dinner parties on the island, and then by allowing a Soho gallery to include a new piece in their 1990s retrospective. The piece had garnered a lot of attention. It was bought by an important collector. Scott's phone started ringing. A few of the bigger reps came out and toured the studio. It was happening. Everything he had worked toward, a life's pursuit, about to be realized. All he had to do was grab the ring. So he got on a plane. A dozen news vans are parked outside the hospital, camera crews assembled and waiting. Police barricades have been erected, half a dozen uniformed officers keeping things orderly. Scott spies on the scene from the hospital lobby, hiding behind a potted ficus. This is where Magnus finds him.
"Jesus, man," he says. "You don't do anything half-assed, do you?"
They man-hug. Magnus is a part-time painter and full-time ladies' man with just a trace of Irish lilt in his voice.
"Thanks for doing this," Scott tells him.
"No worries, brother."
Magnus gives Scott the once-over.
"You look like shite."
"I feel like shite," Scott says. Magnus holds up a duffel bag.
"I brought some skivvies," he says. "A fetching frock and some panties. You want to change?"
Scott looks over Magnus's shoulder. Outside, the crowd is growing. They are there to see him, to get a glimpse, a soundbite from the man who swam for 8 hours through the midnight Atlantic with a 4-year-old boy on his back. He closes his eyes and pictures what will happen once he is dressed, once he steps through those doors, the spotlight and questions, his own face on TV, the circus of it, the blood frenzy.
"There are no accidents," he thinks.
To Scott's left is a long hall and a door that reads locker room.
"I've got a better idea," Scott says, "but it involves you breaking the law."
Magnus smiles.
"Just one?"
10 minutes later, Scott and Magnus walk out a side door. They are both in scrubs now, wearing white lab coats, two doctors going home at the end of a long shift. Scott holds Magnus's cell phone to his ear, talking to the dial tone. The ruse works. They reach Magnus's car, a seen better days Saab with a sun-bleached fabric roof. Inside, Scott reaffixes the sling over his left shoulder.
Just so you know, Magnus tells him, we're definitely wearing these out to the bar later. Ladies love a medical man.
As they drive out past the press line, Scott shields his face with the phone. He thinks about the boy, hunched over and tiny in his wheelchair, an orphan now and forever. Scott has no doubt that his aunt loves him, no doubt that the money he inherits from his parents will insulate him from anything close to ruin. But will it be enough? Can the boy grow up to be normal, or will he be forever broken by what has happened?
I should have gotten the aunt's number, Scott thinks.
But as he does, he wonders what he would do with it. Scott has no right to force his way into their lives. And even if he did, what does he have to offer? The boy is only 4, and Scott is a single man approaching 50, a notorious womanizer and recovered alcoholic, a struggling artist who's never been able to keep a single lasting relationship. He is nobody's role model, nobody's hero. They take the Long Island Expressway toward the city. Scott rolls down the window and feels the wind on his face. Squinting into the sun, he can half convince himself that the events of the last 36 hours were just a dream. That there was no private plane, no crash, no epic swim or harrowing hospital stay. With the right combination of cocktails and professional victories, he could erase it all. But even as he thinks this, Scott knows it's bullshit. The trauma he suffered is part of his DNA now. He is a soldier after an epic battle, one he will inevitably return to 50 years from now on his deathbed. Magnus lives in Long Island City, in a condemned shoe factory that's been converted into lofts. Before the crash, Scott's plan was to stay there for a few days and commute into the city. But now, changing lanes, Magnus tells Scott that things have changed.
I've got strict feckin' instructions, he says, to take you to the West Village. You're moving up in the world.
Strict instructions from who? Scott wants to know.
A new friend, says Magnus.
That's all I can say at this moment.
Pull over, Scott tells him in a hard voice.
Magnus gives Scott a double eyebrow lift, smiles. Scott reaches for his door handle.
Chill, boyo, says Magnus, swerving slightly.
I can see you're in no mood for mystery.
Just tell me where we're going.
Leslie's, says Magnus.
Who's Leslie?
Jeez, did you crack your head in the crash? Leslie Mueller? The Mueller Gallery?
Scott is at a loss.
Why would we go to the Mueller Gallery?
Not the gallery, you tosser, her house. She's a billionaire, yeah? Daughter of that tech geezer who made that gizmo in the 90s. Well, after you called me, I maybe shot my mouth off a bit about how I was coming to get you, and how you and me were going to hit the town, get some ladies' numbers, you being a shit-you-not hero and all. And I guess she heard, because she called me. Says she saw what you did on the news. Says her door is open. She's got a guest suite on the 3rd floor.
No.
Don't be stupid, amigo. This is Leslie Mueller. This is the difference between selling a painting for $3,000 and selling one for $300,000 or $3 million.
No.
Perfect. I hear you.
But think about my career for a minute. This is Leslie fucking Mueller. My last show was at a crab shack in Cleveland. At least, let's go for dinner. Let her rub up against that giant hero boner of yours, commission a few pieces, maybe throw in a good word for your boyo. Then we make excuses.
Scott turns to look out the window. In the car next to them, a couple is arguing. A man and woman in their 20s, dressed for work. The man is behind the wheel, but he isn't looking at the road. His head is turned, and he is waving one hand angrily. In response, the woman holds an open lipstick, half applied, and jabs it in the man's direction, her face lemoned with distaste. Looking at them, Scott has a sudden flash of memory. He is back on the flight, seatbelt on. Up front, at the open cockpit door, the young flight attendant, what was her name, is arguing with one of the pilots. Her back is to Scott, but the pilot's face is visible over her shoulder. It is ugly and dark.
and as Scott watches, the pilot grabs the girl's arm tightly. She pulls away. In the memory, Scott feels the seatbelt clasp in his hand. His feet are flat under him, his quads tensed as if he is about to stand. Why? To go to her aid? It comes in a flash, and then it's gone. An image that could be from a movie, but feels like his life. Did that happen? Was there some kind of fight? In the next lane, the furious driver turns and spits out the window, but the window is up. A frothy rope of spit runs down the curved glass, and then Magnus speeds up and the couple is gone. Scott sees a gas station ahead.
Can you pull in here? Scott asks. I want to get a pack of gum.
Magnus digs around in the center console.
I've got some juicy fruit somewhere.
Something mint, Scott says. Just pull over. Magnus turns in without signaling, parks around the side.
I'll just be a second, Scott tells him.
Get me a Coke. Scott realizes he's wearing scrubs.
Lend me a 20, he says.
Magnus thinks about this.
Okay, but promise we're going to Mueller's. I bet she's got scotch in her cabinets that was bottled before the feckin' Titanic.
Scott looks him in the eye.
Promise.
Magnus pulls a crumpled bill from his pocket.
And some chips, he says.
Scott closes the passenger door. He is wearing disposable flip-flops.
Be right back, he says,
and walks into the gas station convenience store. There is a heavy-set woman behind the counter.
Back door? Scott asks her.
She points. Scott walks down a short hall past the restrooms. He pushes open a heavy fire door and stands squinting in the sun. There is a chain-link fence a few feet away, and behind that, the start of a residential neighborhood. Scott puts the 20 in his front pocket. He tries to climb the fence one-handed, but the sling gets in the way, so he ditches it. A few moments later, he is on the other side, walking through a vacant lot, his flip-flops slapping against his heels. It is late August, and the air is thick and broiled. He pictures Magnus behind the wheel. He will have turned on the radio, found an oldie station. Right now, he's probably singing along with Queen, arching his neck on the high notes. Around Scott, the neighborhood is lower class. Cars on blocks in driveways, above-ground pools sloshing in backyards. He is a man in hospital scrubs and flip-flops walking through the midday heat. A mental patient, for all anybody knows. 30 minutes later, he finds a fried chicken joint, goes inside. It's just a counter and stove with a couple of chairs in front.
You got a phone I could use?
He asks the Dominican guy behind the counter.
Gotta order something, the guy tells him.
Scott orders a bucket of thighs and a ginger ale. The clerk points to a phone on the wall in the kitchen. Scott takes a business card from his pocket and dials. A man answers on the second ring.
NTSB.
Gus Franklin, please, says Scott.
Speaking.
It's Scott Burroughs from the hospital.
Mr. Burroughs, how are you?
Fine. Look, I want to help. With the search, the rescue, whatever. There is silence on the other end of the line.
I'm told you checked out of the hospital, says Gus, somehow without being seen by the press.
Scott thinks about this.
I dressed up like a doctor, he says, and went out the back door.
Gus laughs.
Very clever. Listen, I got divers in the water searching for the fuselage, but it's slow going, and this is a high-profile case. Is there anything you can tell us, anything else you can remember about the crash, what happened before?
It's coming back, Scott tells him. Still just fragments, but let me help with the search. Maybe being out there, maybe it'll shake something loose. Gus thinks about this.
Where are you?
Well, says Scott, let me ask you this. How do you feel about chicken thighs?
Painting number one. The first thing that catches your eye is the light, or rather, two lights angled toward a single focal point, becoming a figure-eight flare at the center of the canvas. It is big, this painting, 8 feet long and 5 feet high, the once white tarpaulin transformed into a smoky gray glitter. Or maybe what you see first is calamity. 2 dark rectangles slicing